Hello and welcome to Reclaiming My Theology, a podcast seeking to take our theology back from ideas and systems that oppress. I'm your host, Brandy Miller, and today I'm joined by D.L. Mayfield to talk about romance and particularly the construction and impact of Christian romance as an industry and a concept. We discuss the ways that the formation of a romantic imagination creates the context for abuse, repression, and relational and political dysfunction. It's all a bit of a doozy, honestly. As we do that, I want to once again thank you so much for supporting the podcast by listening, telling your friends, rating, and reviewing. You can, as always, also keep supporting the podcast in an ongoing way by joining us on Patreon at patreon.com/reclaimingmytheology. Y'all, we are still trekking through this season on purity culture and the ways that it is intrinsically tied to white supremacy, patriarchy, and the political world that we occupy. I want to recognize that we are still doing specific work around purity culture in the midst of all that is happening in our world. And my hope in that is that the greater awareness of these forms of oppression and violence, that those would lead us to justice work in spaces outside of our Christian spaces, including a free Palestine. So we carry on unlearning violence and trying to do better. With all of that, please enjoy this episode with D.L. Mayfield. All right. Well, hey, it's always weird to do these things where we act like we haven't been talking for a few minutes, but I do want to formally welcome you back onto the podcast. You're one of my favorite guests that I've had, and so I'm grateful both for our friendship and for this opportunity to get to talk again. So thanks for being here.
Thank you. It is so nice to see your face, and it's, you know, we do love to shoot the shit together, don't we? So
we really do. And what more could that describe than talking about Christian romance today? And I realize that I'm not going to release this episode for a little bit, but we're recording it right around Valentine's Day. And so some of the weird Christian of it is all in the air anyway in some of the places I'm adjacent to. So I'll be really curious what we come to as we discuss what this looks like and is, and some of the tropes of both the genre, because a genre is what shapes the reality, and how those things play out in spiritual spaces for some people, because that goes deep.
So true. And yeah, I have like a Valentine's Day hangover. Like, the social media of Valentine's Day is wild, isn't it? So this is a great time to be talking about Christian romance.
It really is. Well, for folks who don't know you, as always, I would love for you to describe what it means to be you so they can get to know you a little bit more.
Yeah, this is a really fun exercise because I have been on the pod before, but there's been a few big changes since last time I had a conversation with you. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'll rapid fire just say them really quick. Okay, one, I deconverted from Christianity, so like full out no longer a Christian, which was super awkward because I published Christian books and it was just not a good thing for my career or anything like that. But mm-hmm. I reached a tipping point. I think this is happening to lots of other people, but yeah, so that's been a big deal. I also came out as non-binary, and that has been an interesting experience. I don't know how to explain that too much to people listening, but that is just something that has changed for me. And I think the other big change is I'm not sure I was diagnosed autistic. Maybe I was the last time I was on here, but that's another thing. That's where most of my writing is now centered, is about healing from high control environments and late diagnosed neurodivergence. Those are the things I'm still writing about. If people are interested in those topics.
Those are three giant life-altering major shift things. I feel that.
Gen Z as I say all that. Like, I don't know. But I will just say, like, most of these have been like multiple years, if not decades, in the making. Mm-hmm. And like many people, COVID just put so much pressure on so many areas of my life that I was like, I've got to get this sorted and out in the open. And I had sort of got sucked into the Christian publishing machine as a part of my savior complex. You know the whole thing growing up evangelical. Mm-hmm. It's like, if God gives you a message to say, you need to take up every opportunity to say it. So now I don't do that anymore. But I just do my weird little writing on the side. So anywho, all that to say, yes, big changes, but I'm still me.
I still
want to talk shit about Christian romance. So,
because there is so much to say. Well, before we get into that part specifically, I'd love to hear again a little bit of your history with purity culture as a concept, because part of our engaging with this is kind of reviewing a little bit of our own experience. So could you talk to me a little bit about purity culture, and then I'll ask a little bit out of your history or your association with romance in general?
Yes. Okay. So I'm going to make a weird connection here, but even me just saying those like three qualifiers, I'm an ex-Christian, I'm non-binary, I'm autistic. I feel shame when I said those three things to you, and I felt like, oh, I'm being so navel-gazy. Like, what's the point? And I actually think that is sort of connected to purity culture. And I also think it is connected to like white supremacy culture. So when I grew up, there's a lot of like, don't focus on labels. People who focus on labels, right? Wow. They certainly don't rely on God. They're listening to all these other things, and all these labels will somehow take you away from your true identity, which is Christian, right? Mm-hmm. So that's how I was raised. If people grew up in evangelicalism, maybe they have a similar thing. I do think this has connections to romance, like really, to use the word, explicit connections. So like for me, even there wasn't any talk of different like gender expressions or different sexualities, mm-hmm. right? It was just really intense cis heteronormativity. And I did not fit anything that I saw in Christian romance. So my mom did work for Multnomah Publishing for a while. So I had access to all of these Christian romance books, mostly in high school, but in middle school, I remember reading a lot of them too, because they were safe. I could read them, and I just couldn't connect with any of them. Now, I think that's probably related to being gender nonconforming, right? Being non-binary. Mm-hmm. I was very mask presenting as a teenager. I actually dressed like a boy for 3 years straight, and people thought I was just a little weirdo, which I was, but that's the autism, right? But I also did not experience a lot of sexual attraction to people, and almost zero romantic attraction to people. And so now, right, going back to labels, the more I've looked into it, I'm like, oh, I'm definitely somewhere on the asexual spectrum. And I identify as demisexual, right? Which means you really only experience sexual connection when you are in a deep relationship. And of course that wasn't talked about growing up,
right?
But it was sort of seen as the ideal, I would say, in purity culture. This will be an interesting question to ask you. What do you think was sort of the ideal? We know what the ideal was of gender expression, hyperfemininity for girls, right? Hypermasculinity for boys. But as far as sexuality, what was it they were trying to get into teenagers? And I think maybe it's a little different for people when they're older, but I just want to ask you your thoughts on that.
Yeah. Do you mean in sexuality in terms of like sex as practice, or sexuality as an identification?
I mean, identification, right? It's you gotta be straight, but yeah, I mean like varying levels of attraction, right? And varying degrees of what you find attractive or romantic, yes. right? Because not everybody actually experiences romantic desire. And I heard none of that growing up.
Right.
Right?
Yes. And I think I wonder for me, part of what I grew up with was heavy, heavy, heavy binaries, where it was men see the world with, you know, like men experience the world through their eyes first, and like their eyes are basically just like directly connected to their genitals. And so you need to
like
make sure that like,
those
are like the two parts that make up a man. And you're like, okay, so if men are visual creatures, but like women are emotional, I think there was some attempt to solidify those, because if a man like sees with his eyes and he's powerful and the penis is like this symbol of power and might and spreading your seed in the world, then there is a way in which it upholds patriarchy in a particular way by creating a context where men are, you know, like literally penetrating or like altering the state of a person's body, like by, you know, I just did this episode on virginity, by inserting themselves into somebody. So like a man's body changes the world, and which fits, right, when you think about Jesus and a body broken and flesh and all of this stuff. And so I think there was something connected to those things, even though no one was thinking specifically about attraction. But I think what I also would say, maybe more frankly, is that a lack of sexual attraction was only known in like the 80s, 90s, early 2000s as being gay. And so you try to make sexual attraction and sex drive a part of what it means to be a man. And so libido and like not having erectile dysfunction or, you know, whatever, all of those things became a part of a defining of masculinity up and against queerness. And so I think that part of it was around, it was like a theological no homo.
That's such a good point. It's, you know, it's queer, right, to not want sex all the time and to not desire romantic relationships, right, especially the ones that were given to us. And that's definitely how I felt. And yet also, it was also privileged and prioritized in certain ways, right? As someone who was socialized as female, as white, it was actually seen as a really good thing, right, that I was not sexually promiscuous, that I was not, mm-hmm. you know, doing all these things. And so I sort of thought, like, why is it hard for people to stay, you know, to stay sexually pure until they got married? You know, that's the language we used.
Yes.
And now I'm like, well, it was easy for me. That doesn't mean it was most people's reality. And that's why yes. labels are so great. Not only does it help me understand myself, it helps me not pass judgment onto people who are different than me. And I think,
yes.
obviously, there's a lot of judgment baked into, like, Christian dating manuals and all these things. And what's fascinating is Christian romance gets to talk about these exact same issues, but just through a different lens. And what I gleaned from reading all these Christian romance books, right, is basically, like, this is what you're supposed to desire more than anything else besides God. You know, besides mm-hmm. God. But this is a very close second, that this is the biggest yes. deal of your life.
Yeah. And I think that idea that it's the biggest deal of your life is really hard, because then it makes it so that if you have a lack of romantic or sexual attraction, you are missing out on the highest form of love or the highest form of connection that you can experience mm-hmm. outside of loving and being loved by God, God's self. And part of how I think that got framed or socialized was that people who... And we did not have the language for asexuality in my no. spaces at all. Like, this is such a new iteration of language for in my own life in the last decade, probably less than that, honestly. And so, but what I think, because we had a lack of that, the only way that people would categorize people who didn't pursue romantic or sexual anything was that they were sacrificing for the gospel. And so we would yes. make people who were not ace necessarily ace, and then be like, well, that asexuality is a choice that you're making, or your aromanticism is a choice that you're making rather than an identity that you hold that makes you closer to God. And we're like, well, Paul, and we'll talk about how he, like, well, and you can talk about the history of whether he's married or not, but, or was married or not, but it's the, you know, the focus on Christ, the, I would, you know, if you can be single and celibate, you should be, because it's going to give you a higher focus on God. And we take people like Mother Teresa and be like, see, she didn't partner and she lived her whole life serving the poor. And so there becomes this conflation of a lack of romanticism or a lack of sex or sexuality or sexualization in some way to piety, missionary endeavors, and a wholehearted singular focus on the gospel.
Yes. And that is exactly where I got funneled into, right? I think early on, my family clocked that I wasn't, it didn't seem like I was going to fit the mold of an evangelical white woman, right? So I was told very early on, you need to be a missionary. You need to be a missionary. You're going to be a single woman missionary your whole life because God's the most important thing to you. And I went to college to be a missionary. Like, it's so embarrassing because of, like, all the colonizer vibes. And yet there's also yes. this element of, that's where they put gender non-conforming people socialized as mm-hmm. women. Like, that's what we were given. And I did it, you know? And it, what is interesting is I ended up meeting someone and being very attracted to them, marrying that person. And I've been very happily married to him for almost 17 years now. And so, like, my story is a little unique and interesting, but I look back and I'm like, I'm pretty sad for myself. Like, that was the only option given to me in that framework. And I don't think I'm the only one that happened to,
no.
you know? Yeah.
No. And can I just note something really complex in what you're saying, which is that as a non-binary person, as an ace person, because you're not given language or space to explore who you are, there's a particular grieving or, and I hear this from late in life queers all the time, mm-hmm. that there is this particular type of grieving you have to do around
the choices that you did not get to make, even if you are happy in the decisions that you did make. Like that there is a way to hold, oh, I can be happy. I can have been happily married for 17 years and love my partner. And there is still something that I can recognize is lost or needs tending to that wasn't offered to me. And I think for a lot of married, queer, femmes and non-binary folks, that is a very real story. And one that a lot of men in their lives do not know how to engage with. Do not know how to hold undefensively and don't know how to hold without being like, well, now you're just going to leave me, right? And so I think a lot of masculine defensiveness shows up in that particularity that I think a lot of more people experience than we would think do.
Yeah, that's, I love that you said that. And it's just, it's very tender. And yet it's also like, it's so normal and healthy for people who grew up like me. Like I have a podcast I do with my partner. And our little community, we process a lot of religious trauma. And a lot of people are like, yeah, I wish I had made out with so many more people, right? Before entering this monogamous relationship. And even just that, normalize saying that. Normalize saying that to your partner. Normalize all this stuff because it's like, it's a big deal in some ways, but it's also not in others. And the more we truly love people in our lives, the more we just want them to be who they actually are, because that has positive benefits for everything, including their mental and physical health. So I'm like, it's a complicated little mess, but the labels are so helpful to me, and I know they've been so helpful to other people for them to process both their past with now these new languages, you know, not languages, these new terms we have. And then integrating that into our present. But again, Christian romance and Christian publishing and evangelical culture in particular, right, hates all these labels. And they hate it when people self-reflect beyond these really huge categories of gender binaries, right? So that's where I'm like, you want to stick it to the white evangelical man? You do some navel gazing. You look at labels. You figure out what works best for you. And guess what? If later on it doesn't seem to fit, you can change. That is another thing that I love. I mean, sometimes it is sort of like brings up the shame for me to be like, I wasn't diagnosed autistic till I was 37. I'm almost 40 now. You know, I didn't come out as non-binary till last year. And I'm like, does this mean I was super unself-aware? Like, what's going on? But there's a part of me that's like, it's beautiful to be a human and be like, I get to change. I get to change. And that is like so at odds with me growing up and hearing Apostle Paul, like, just run the race and, you know, get to the finish line. And I've like totally fucked up the race in so many ways, including not being a Christian anymore. Now, will I come back to faith at some point? I might, you know. I'm allowed to change if I want to. But for now, I'm just like, oh, I dropped out of a lot of races, including the race of like white Christian femininity, which I was never good at. Oh, my God. But I try. I wore the scarves. You know what I mean? I would speak at these conferences. I would wear these scarves draped around my neck and sweaters. I never had pierced ears, but I would try and curl my hair. And it just, I was trying to fit in, Brandy. And now I don't have to do that anymore.
Which is wonderful. I'm glad you've dropped out of that race. And I think the principle that you're expressing is that everyone gets the opportunity not just to be, but to become, and to let our lives be a journey of becoming rather than just trying to perform a certain end goal of Christian or Christian adjacent spirituality for a lot of folks who are at least listening to the podcast. Yeah. So you say all of that. And I'm like, okay, then what is Christian romance? Because I think when I think about romance in general, it feels more like vibes to me than it does like anything concrete. That romance is something that you feel, and it might be something that you practice. It might be something that you might romanticize something, which isn't usually like a great thing. It's like making something better than it actually is in our minds. So when we're talking about Christian romance, what are we talking about?
Yeah, I love this question. So for somebody who is on the asexual spectrum, I read a lot of Christian romance, okay? And a part of it was that was what I had access to as an isolated homeschooled kid. But it for my podcast, I actually have reread a lot of like the best-selling Christian romance books and sort of dissected them for their themes. So I don't know if you have any specific like Christian romances that you read growing up that you really want to shit talk. Or I can just sort of launch into what I see as some overarching themes.
I mean, the main one that was present in my life was, okay, there's two things. One is a show and the other is a book.
Oh,
the book
show?
That I was
okay.
most, and that show was Seventh Heaven.
Oh my God, what a mess that show is.
Awful. So awful.
In every direction.
So awful. But in Seventh Heaven, which for those of you that don't know, was a show in the late 90s, I think, early 2000s, maybe a little bit before that, that focused on a family, a Christian family, I say led in heavy quotes, but led by a pastor and his wife, but by the pastor, and they had seven kids and some dogs, and it chronicled the story of these kids as they're being parented by this pastor. And every episode had essentially a moral object lesson. And the ways that they framed romance were so hetero, were so puritanical, and not just like purity culture, like puritanical, like longing for a different time where everything was easier and the world was less immoral and less, and you know, like less far from the Garden of Eden, all of this stuff. And that show, I think, modeled a lot of very vanilla relationships and a lot of object lessons about the terrible things that would happen to you if you dated someone who wasn't a Christian mm-hmm. or who didn't fall into a perfect moral values code. And so I think a lot of my Christian romance upbringing happened before I was a Christian because I really liked Seventh Heaven as a show.
Wow. Do you know the story about the guy who played the pastor in that
Icky
show?
Man. That man's Icky.
He's a child predator.
Yep,
like
he sure
prison.
Is. Yep.
Which is fascinating since quite a few evangelical male pastors, right, have... Anywho, that is hilarious because my parents thought that show was too liberal.
Oh!
If that gives you a peek into my
whoa.
Life.
Whoa, that's wild.
Yeah, because they actually got to date. My parents were like, you got to court. Maybe that's also why I wasn't interested in dating. I was just like... Oh my freaking God, I can't imagine being married to any of these dipshits in my youth.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Okay, so there's that show. What else?
And then there was the book, was it Francine Rivers? Is that what her last name is? Who wrote Redeeming Love, which is an allegory of an allegory. So Francine Rivers is writing a romance story about a woman with a dark past meets a super, super loving man. I think his name's Michael, maybe. Yep. And it's like her just journey of discovering that the real thing that she needs is God's love. But the way that she's going to find that love is through the love of a man. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that book, which was read by so many women I knew, changed some of the language of how we thought about romance, which was like thinking about like a man who finds you and makes you feel worthy or deserving. And so it became this kind of confusion between men that you would be dating or courting and God's self, so that the man is a proxy through which you more deeply know God's love. And so there felt to me like a spiritual imperative to find a husband or to like see having a husband as a reward for faithfulness because it was a thing that would get me closer to God.
Yeah, so I reread that book a few years ago for a podcast episode I did on it, and it is one of the most disturbing books I've ever read because it equates like childhood trauma and like forced sex work as sin. So that is the female protagonist's sin, right? She had a shitty childhood and then she was forced into a life of being a sex worker in the 1800s, you know, Wild West, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then Michael has to redeem her, right? By loving her, even though she's so impure and so defiled and all this stuff, and sometimes he gets so mad at her he almost like beats her, but then he like holds back, you know, and it's like he's supposed to be seen as so amazing. It's like so bad. It made my stomach hurt. Like I was physically ill when I was rereading it because I'm like, yeah, this has sold so many copies. Now when we talk about Christian romance, I think a thing I'm really interested right now is like the book I Kissed Dating Goodbye has been talked about so much, right?
Yes.
And that sold 1.2 million copies, right?
Yeah.
Which is a lot.
It's
but
a
like
lot.
Redeeming Love has sold 3 million. So
three
more.
Yeah.
Okay. And then I've recently been obsessed with this couple that wrote historical Christian romances, and they've churned out like 65 of them. Their names are Brock and Bodhi Taney. Okay. Mm-hmm. They've sold over 10 million copies of their Christian romance books. 10 million. Okay.
That's wild.
And their books, now this is going to turn the conversation in a direction you can either continue to take it or not, Brandy. Their
sure.
books, they're historical Christian romances that are aimed at creating people who are pro-Israel and who are Zionists. So most of their books are centered around the creation of the nation state of Israel in 1948 or the years, you know, right before that or the time of Jesus. Both of those times they get to talk about their Christian Zionism stuff. 10 million copies using romance as a vehicle for getting people to support the modern nation state of Israel. Like, now that's interesting to me because mm-hmm. the more I have researched this, I used to also think that Christian romance was just about vibes. Here's a vibe I experienced a few years ago. I walked into a local Christian bookstore. When I walked in, I was like, this is creepy. A bunch of white women wearing bonnets are staring back at me because that's all the store was basically Amish fiction from, you know, one end of the store to the other. Like, Amish fiction became a huge trend in Christian publishing. And everybody's like, yeah, it makes sense. It's old school. Nobody has sex. It's clean. And I'm like, there's also the whiteness. You know, there's
yes.
also all this going on. When you see it in front of you, you're like, something's really off here. And so what I've sort of come to the conclusion, again, I'm not a scholar. There's other people who are doing amazing work in this. And I'm just like a lay person who gets obsessed with these things. Mm. But yeah. I'm working on a book project about evangelical authoritarian parenting methods. Think Dr. Dobson, mm. all this stuff.
Yeah.
Well, surprise, surprise, the origins of all that shit as well are white supremacy. And to be more concrete, it's positive eugenics. It became very unfashionable to talk about straight up eugenics after World War II in the United States. Before then, there's a lot of Nazi sympathizers. There was a lot of people writing and making their careers off of being extremely pro-eugenics. After World War II, they're like, we can't do that anymore. So they switched to something they call positive eugenics. How do we get white women to remain sexually pure, marry white men, and then have as many kids as possible, and indoctrinate them to continue on their political and ideological beliefs? Okay? So that was what Dr. Dobson did. He was the protege of a very famous eugenicist known as Paul Popenoe, right? Paul mm-hmm. Popenoe actually wrote the foreword to Dare to Discipline. People don't want to talk about that mm-hmm. shit. So for me, Christian romance fits squarely in this positive eugenics movement where it's convincing white women, right, to remain sexually pure till they meet a white man and then dedicate their life to homemaking, to having kids, to serving the Lord, and to passing down the values of their faith. Now, their mm-hmm. faith is absolutely tied to their politics and to their whiteness. Mm-hmm. So that's how I view it now, is Christian romance is like a positive eugenics movement. But that could be a little too
Woof.
Intense for me, but I get that. But that's kind of how it seems to me.
Well, and it makes sense to me that would be the case, because I have wondered and thought a lot about, you said you see a bunch of women in bonnets, white women in bonnets staring back at you. I've been asking the question for the last few years, why is most Christian romance framed as being in the past?
Yes.
Like, why is it framed as the 1850s or medieval times or things like that? And I think it can tie pretty easily to some of the maybe like MAGA dynamics of like, there was this time before our time that was better than our time. And if we can look back to that time and tell stories that romanticize that time, we will move ourselves away from the what they would see as apocalyptic experience that we're in right now. And again, I think there's a lot of, in some evangelical spaces, like way, way more conservative and conspiracy theorists, frankly, some idea that we're living in the end times. Mm-hmm. And so if we start to talk about like things like end times, Christian romance has to be a act of faithfulness, an act of moral grounded centeredness to be the faithful during the end times. And so it makes sense that if modern is the end times, you're not going to write Christian love stories about people living through dystopian hell. Instead, you're going to do it about fictional people in fictionalizations of historical periods where you can superimpose or hyperimpose certain tenets and values and call them normal. Because if you tried to write, and I know people are, the same types of gender norms and binaries into novels now, they would be much harder to square away because you'd have to ignore a huge facet of the population. Where if you say, well, it was the 1850s, like there were no gay people in the 1850s, or there was no sexual immorality in the 1850s, you can fictionalize a purity that didn't exist by not framing things in modern terms that people would have questions about now.
I mean, yeah, I think you said it. I think it really is as simple as the patriarchal dream of the world, right, is a world where women don't have rights. They can't mm-hmm. divorce. They are dependent on a good, godly man, right, keeping them safe. And there's no birth control, so they're going to have tons of kids and dedicate their whole life to taking care of those kids. Like, that's the dream. I mean, going back to Dr. Dobson, because I do think the 1960s in particular is such an important moment in Christian publishing. Mm-hmm. And I think Christian publishing has impacted the United States way more than we want to believe. And yes. I think the Christian romance genre, right, since the 1980s has exploded and become such a huge part of the Christian fiction market, right? It's like mm-hmm. over 2/3 of all Christian fiction is romance. Wild. And if you look at them, the vast majority of them are in time periods where women had no rights, gay people supposedly mm-hmm. didn't exist, and it's just white people, as far as the eye can see, right? As the protagonists, yes. as the pioneers. There's lots of pioneer themes. Mm-hmm. Yes. The Amish are interesting because you can sort of do some modern stuff with the Amish, but then it still feeds into that pioneer kind of thing.
It really does.
I am like, it kind of is that simple. Like, we long for this world, and we would like our women to long for this as well. Now, I'm someone, and this is really odd, I'm really into, like, Regency era England romance books, okay? Started with Jane Austen. And now Jane Austen is a huge deal for a lot of people. And I love, like, retellings of Regency England. And a part of me is like, this is weird. Like, women did not have rights in this society either. Most of these stories are kind of centered around people who are wealthy. Like, what's going on? I think at some point, though, that time period was a time of like huge societal change and upheaval. And mm-hmm. Jane Austen literally was one of the first women who was allowed to write, romance. And she was fantastically angry about the system. Mm-hmm. And I think the best Regency era romance written by women, people socialized as female, there is this level of like the world is changing. We get to write, and we get to write about women who are still trapped mm-hmm. in this hierarchy, but we get to make fun of the intense class system happening in England. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, I don't know. Sorry, maybe that was a tangent, but I'm like, I don't think you can lump all romance together, and I don't think you can lump all period romance together either, because it really depends on what the author's trying to do.
Yes, and what I hear in that is a really specific contrast to what Christian romance as a genre tries to do, which is to say the world is changing and we need to hold on to these particular morals and values.
Here are
heart-wrenching or moving or emotionally evocative stories of people who are making the sacrifices to hold on to something bigger or better or more holy or more spiritual than themselves. And in that, I think I hear us saying, so you and I are both people who can go hard and deep politically fast. Yeah. And I think there might be some folks who don't know just like the basics of Christian romance. And what are some of the tenets of these genres? I've heard you say that's hypermasculinity and hyperfemininity. Mm-hmm. But what are some of the things that show up in Christian romance? Because, and I want to ask this because I think that many of us don't know that we've been socialized to want Christian romance, whether you're Christian or not, or a Christianized romance, by the media that has shaped Christian subcultures. And so I think if we can name some of those things that feel like they are present in Christian romance, it might help us to unnormalize, that's not a word, but help us to move away from the normalization of Western Christian values around romance being both the most moral or the most holy or the most good or sought after. One example I can think of is the idea of a pursuing partner. Mm-hmm. By that I mean a pursuing man. Like the most romantic thing that can happen in a romance novel, a Christian romance novel, is a chase or is a pursuing that is unyielding, as God's love is unyielding in the midst of resistance or conflict or obstacle. And so every Christian romance novel that I've seen has some kind of moral obstacle that a couple has to overcome in order to make a lifelong commitment. And so every relationship and everything about romance is about a lifelong commitment that is birthed out of overcoming an obstacle that a man overcomes in order to pursue in an intense way a woman in a story.
Wow. I love that you're sort of forcing me to like step back, because you're right. I was raised in this world. I'm just like, this is just what it is. But I think you've already mentioned a few things in this podcast. So like, one is that, you know, marriage is the end goal, right? Marriage mm-hmm. is the ultimate end goal. Now I'll just ask you this question, Brandy. I'm sure you know the answer. Is divorce ever a thing? Like, should that happen? Or once you're married, are you married for life?
Not in Christian romance. Nope, cord of three strands isn't easily broken, baby.
Or like Christian culture in general, right? And so I think that's really important. It's like, once you get married, you're married for life. Now, the other thing, you actually already mentioned this too, and it really stood out to me. You can only be romantically interested in someone who is a Christian. Now, here's where we're going to get into something very interesting. And that really, I think, caused me to be like, well, none of these relate to me. In these Christian romance books, the woman, well, eventually the man has to become the spiritual leader, right? Yes. Maybe he's not at the beginning of the book, still Christian, but sort of nominal or whatever. Sometimes that happens. But by the end, right, it's very clear. The man is the more devout one in some ways, is the spiritual leader, should be listened to as someone who hears from God. And so in a lot of Christian romance, like, the man prays, like Francine Rivers did this all the time, right? Michael's always talking to God, and it just is to show that he's so godly mm-hmm. and all these things. Now, when I was in middle school, high school, college, I was always way more into God than any boy I knew. Yeah. So it's same. Like, well, I can't, first of all, I didn't want anyone to, you know, tell me what to do. Second, I'm like, I know way more than all of these yes. people. Therefore, I do not see anything modeled where, like, the woman is the one that's super into God, and then the dude's just sort of like, I'm along for the ride. Tell me what to do. Which, to be perfectly yes. honest, that's how my marriage has been.
Christmas that tracks
along for the ride, let me tell you. And so I just think, like, that is actually a little bit more insidious than we want to think of it, right? Because once you establish that the man hears from God in a way that women don't, right, their authority cannot be questioned, and mm-hmm. it just adds to this, like, subservience that ends up happening in these relationships. So those are the two things that yes. came to mind that I was like, wow, it's just in the air I've breathed, and I didn't even think about it. But you have to be partnered with a Christian. It has to end with a lifelong commitment in marriage and kids. Yes. I think that's another huge thing, is like this yes. assumption. And again, going to all the Amish, all the pioneer, all this stuff, like, people have so many kids. And I'm yes. like, yeah, that's the positive eugenics piece, y'all. Like, that's kind of yep. the whole point of this thing. And yep. most of the partnerships are not interracial, if there's, you no. know, even a person of color as one of the protagonists, you know, so it's pretty bad all around.
Yeah. And it's interesting because that gets tagged onto a lot of Christian romance as an epilogue. Like, the climax of the story is the conflict resolution mm-hmm. that leads them to know that they're deeply in love. Then there's a wedding. And this is interesting because this actually plays out in a ton of secular stuff where the climax of every story or the resolution of every story is marriage or prom, even, because prom is like the closest thing that you can put teenagers to getting married without marrying them off. It centers a heteronormative story of some sort of like commitment. And so it, like, the stories rarely are about like, oh, and then they had sex and that was it, you know. So there's all kinds of interesting things there. But I want to go back to what you were talking about around the kind of Christ leader bit, because that that idea that there's this man who is the closest to God, who is leading his future family, or leading in a way that will like make him a leader of his future family, is born out of a anti-Semitic hermeneutic that searches every Bible story for a Christological archetype that says there's this hermeneutic model that a lot of evangelical pastors follow that says that you can find Christ in the Hebrew scriptures, mm-hmm. and that you are always looking for the person who is most like Jesus. And oftentimes there is nobody, but you always have to find, it's the way of expressing the presence of the Trinity, I guess, in those spaces. And so when you've been taught to read the Bible as a space to look for the most spiritual figure, Christian romance reifies that by saying there has to be a most Christ-like figure. There has to be a most Christian person who is doing the leading, who is the person we point to as the redeemer in the narrative, because every narrative has to have redemption. And so I think that's another tenet of Christian romance, is that it always has positive, happily ever after types of resolution. And that happily ever after is framed in the ways that you're describing as heteronormative marriage with lots of kids. And that all of that gets tied to some kind of element of faith throughout the plot. So there's always a thread at the top or bottom somewhere of like faith is like a invisible character, an invisible narrator in a lot of Christian romance. And so if something doesn't feel explicitly spiritual, it may not count as Christian romance.
Yeah, and I mean, there's so many different ways that it just, like, really teaches, I think, people socialize as female to put up with horrendous amounts of shit from their partners, right? Mm-hmm. I was thinking about, obviously, there's some, like, YA books also in the Christian scene. For people who grew up in, like, white evangelicalism or had Christian publishing, the Christy Miller series were, like, a big deal when I was a kid. And basically, the main character Christy through all these books, she's in love with this guy Todd, and he is like such a gaslighter, and he'll be really nice to her one day and then like not talk to her for 5 months, and it's all sort of like a test, you know, is she like able to wait for him, and doesn't she trust in God's timing? And it's like, couldn't you have like wrote a letter, my dude? Like it just sets up all these things of like, you can't ask too much of the man, like they're trusting in God's timing. Like, why aren't you? Like, it's so weird how this just comes up in so many ways. And it causes, you know, people socialized as female to doubt themselves, to mm-hmm. always say, like, you're right, the man knows better. I must be so unholy because I'm anxious because mm-hmm. I don't have anybody to go to prom with because the guy I'm in love with, you know, went to Costa Rica on a mission trip and didn't tell me. You know, stuff like that. It's like that scene is so holy and good when the guy cares about God more than you. Like, that's mm-hmm. something that you actually want in your life, which I will tell you now. That actually makes for some pretty miserable partnerships, you know, no matter yes. who in the relationship is into God more than their partner, right? It's just like, wow, right. that is not actually that romantic. And I think we can both say, like, I didn't learn about consent from these books.
No.
And I certainly didn't learn that the sexiest thing you can do is ask for what you want in a partnership. Mm-hmm. I actually got the exact yeah. opposite message from most of these yes. Christian romance books. You shove that deep down, you pray about it, and your godly man will do what God tells him to do, I guess. And I just think that's so sad. Your life can be so yes. much better if you learn to ask for what you want and what you need in a relationship. Yes. And that will really help you understand if you're in a good relationship or not too. And I just think like these are basic things yes. and they were not in these books on purpose, right?
Yes.
And that's kind of sad to me.
Yes. And that in that a intuition about relationship and sex is what is considered romantic rather than asking questions, that there's an assumption exactly. that partners need to know
things. The Holy Spirit
is
sexy, but nothing else.
Well, and I Yes. Well, and I think that has to be the case when sex is all or nothing. It's you don't have sex, you don't have sex, you don't have sex, you don't talk about sex, you don't learn about sex, you don't get quality sexual education. And then you get married and suddenly your sex is supposed to be transcendent. And it's because good sex is the reward for not having sex. And so you don't learn how to have a language in Christian romance spaces of asking good questions about your own body or about someone else's. And you just let your body do all of the work rather than letting your brain be a part of a sexual encounter that is happening, or sensual encounter, intimate space. Like, no, our brains get so disconnected because it's just like, well, then your body's going to experience something super duper amazing. And like, it shouldn't require words, when for those of us who are verbal, like, words are going to matter.
Yeah.
Words totally. Are going to matter.
Totally. And just in creating that communication, I mean, there's so many things about growing up in white evangelicalism that I'm like, wow, so much of it was aimed at getting me divorced from my physical body and knowing what I like, knowing what I need. And this is why I've become kind of passionate about talking about more of like the cult-like dynamics that are at play in white evangelicalism, because being disconnected from your body, being disconnected from your wants and needs, because the main goal, God, is so much more important, right? Think about how many of the worship songs were like, less of me, more of you, like, conform my will to yours. Like, we're literally trying to align ourselves with these words as we're singing them. And then it impacts every part of us, including, right, our sexual relationships. And I think, the Christian romance books, that's another thing. They're very clean. Okay, Francine Rivers was like the most controversial, because she kind of talked about sex a little bit in her books. But every other one is just extreme. Like, I mean, in romance, they talk about like open door, closed door. This is like door slam shut. I don't know if they ever actually have sex. Like, it's, I don't know if you experienced that in reading these books, but they're so deeply unsexy.
Yes. Yes,
to me,
which is so...
Maybe I'm just a weird little, you know, demisexual, but...
Well, and I think what makes Christian romance novels sexy to Christians is that it's your only access point to romance and sex. That you're supposed to shut out everything that's even adjacent. So if you want to have like any kind of romantic feeling or to explore that within yourself, Christian romance as a genre gives a space to explore those feelings that you can't explore anywhere else. And so while there may not be sex or anything explicit in those books, it's the space where people's brains get to fill in at least like one step further than would typically be the case in most Christian spaces. And so I think that there's something about that that feels significant to me. And it gets me thinking about how this shows up in non-Christian works or non-explicitly Christian works. Because there's two parts of this. One is that there is an ethos in Christian romance that Christian romance should be palatable to secular audiences. And so a lot of Christian romance is not overtly preachy. It's not like, oh, and then they believed in Jesus Christ as their savior. It's more of, and this is the example I was thinking of, the Nicholas Sparks A Walk to Remember vibe, where, you know, in A Walk to Remember, I think it's, I can only think of Jamie. I'm like, Mandy Moore and
Is Mandy
Josh
Moore,
Hart?
Somebody.
It's Shane West.
Okay.
I'm like, okay, I know those aren't the character names. I think it's Jamie and then somebody else. But the girl is very, very Christian, but uh-oh, she's dying of cancer. And as she's dying, she falls in love with that white man. And he's this rebel who becomes more and more moral as he's in proximity to her. And that when she dies, like the kind of the final scenes are him, you know, it's them getting married in a Christian wedding in a church. There's like barely an allusion to sex at all. And then she's dead. And that's like kind of how the story goes. And it's this way of saying that the most romantic thing that he can do is change to be more like her God and give her this wish of having a Christian husband. And then when she dies, he's left being a Christian with the legacy that she offered him. And so while there's a gender inversion in that story, the principles are still the same. There is this like sexlessness. There's this pursuing. There's this courting. There's this overcoming of obstacles that makes everyone more Christian, but in a way that feels somehow like romantic and maybe good while being completely void of any kind of actual meaning or situation or and situating in reality.
Oh my God. Now, let's do a thought experiment. Let's say she wasn't dying of cancer. He would have to become more godly than her, right?
Yes. Yes.
And the only reason that that movie worked for Christians is because she died.
Because
now
she dies.
Gets to be a Christian, right? Because she was much more obviously devout than him, and that was the whole thing. Now, what's funny is my partner Crispin loved that movie. He is hyper romantic, and that's one of the things he was given access to, right? And he tried to play me some of those like Switchfoot songs when we were first dating. I was just like, this is so cringe. Like, but that movie was so important to a lot of Christian youth group kids. Brady, I'm glad you brought it up.
It really was. And I think that there is something about the moral of that story, which is essentially that it's like God brought me this girl. And in Christian romance, and I think if we can shift a little just from like from Christian romance as a genre to the implications of Christian romance on people and how we live that out, one of the things is that it feels like a real Christian romance is a supernatural occurrence that is ordained by God. That there has to be, that your love story has to be a miracle. It has to be like two people at the right time finding each other, and it was clearly God. And while I think that could be true, like I'm like, yeah, it does seem like a lot of us meet in really particular and strange ways. The need to make something as simple as love a miracle makes Christians act all kinds of freaking weird. Like, it's the Bible college stereotype of Bible college man sees woman and is like, God told me you're my wife. And they're like, oh my gosh, you hear from God, but I don't hear that. But maybe I should just like consider this just in case. And because there is a rooting in your relationship needs to be supernatural and God ordained. And so I think that that's one of the ways that I see these Christian romance ideologies playing out in collective space. But yeah, what are some of the ways that you see Christian romance, or have you seen in your own experience Christian, what is romantic in a Christian space framed? Because what I will say is, normally I talk way more about the Bible on this podcast, but the Bible is not concerned with romance at all.
Thank you for saying that.
It's not concerned with romance at all. And
not
so
a whit.
And so this industry around creating Christian romance is literally not biblical. Like, I was doing some research for this, and they were like, the 8 most romantic stories in the Bible. And 2 of the 8, well, 3 of the 8 were to me, I was like, this is, it was Jacob and Rachel and Leah, and they called it a love triangle.
A love thruple.
And then, I was like, this man did not know what his partner looked like. He worked for 7 years for a girl, and he did not recognize her on his wedding. Like, that's not a good look. And then the other 2 that they mentioned were Samson and Delilah. And I was like, famously a bad story. And then David
toxic
and Bathsheba. And I was assault and violence. I was like, this is in a Christian blog about romance. And so when we center these stories that are not concerned with romance in how we teach Christians to pursue romantic relationships, we're only going to be left with really, really strange cultural dynamics that I'd love for us to name a few of as we get ready to close soon.
Yes, I'm so glad you said this, because one of the things I realized a few years ago was like, there's not a single relationship in the scriptures that I would want to be in, right? And yet
yes.
My entire life, my dad's a pastor, right? I've heard about David being such a great man. I've heard about all these patriarchs, and like, the older I get, the more I'm just like, all of this sucks for the women. So even a few years ago, right, when I was going through Redeeming Love, I'm like, okay, the story of, you know, Hosea and Gomer and all these things, like, okay, now I'm just like, I can read that story in the scriptures and be like, this sucks too. Like, all of this sucks. Like, I don't need to spiritualize this or make this okay or good for the women in that story, because frankly, I don't think it is. And I think that's just important for us to keep in our minds. Like, this is not a biblical concept. So what is the point of romanticizing these patriarchal relationships, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it is pretty insidious. So I'm turning 40. I went to Bible college. That's where I met my partner. I know of so many people who entered marriages with abusive men who utilize the language that these books traffic in to say,
yep,
God told me this is special, this is divine, you know. Yes, we have, I might have some issues, but God's working on me. I hope you forgive me, like a good mm-hmm. Christian would. And people have children with men that are very abusive. They have multiple children yes. with them because that's just yes. what you do in these partnerships.
Yes.
These men never work on themselves. They never learn the skills of emotional regulation. And they use religious language. And then the churches they attend support the men when things get yep. worse and worse and worse. And when the women divorce, they lose, like, all the support they have.
Everything.
I know a lot of single moms with Christian yes. ex-husbands who are still preaching at their churches who don't pay a dime of child support. I wish I yes. didn't know this, Brandy. I wish this wasn't yes. happening to my yes. peers. But yes. that is the end goal of this bullshit. So I'm sorry. I get a little passionate about it. It's happened to people in my family. It's happened to people I love. And and just the way that spiritual language, I'm the spiritual authority, God is in this relationship, and they use Christianity to sort of get people entangled in into relationships mm-hmm. with them. So I'm sorry, maybe that's too intense, but that's how I see it's not playing out.
And I think the emotional component of that is hard, because for people who are not aromantic, we're learning messages about what is supposed to be romantic, and then when those things are given to us, we might feel things that we might not actually feel if we hadn't been socialized into thinking they are romantic. And so, like, a person who's, like, just so passionate, or, like, who's trying to grow in the Lord, or, like, yep. we'll put all these weird bits of language around that kind of abuse, but also romanticize, like, a man that can change, or someone who's given it a go. And so I think that the bar for men gets lower and lower. And part of the reason I want to name that, the part of the reason we're talking about in binaries and about women specifically mm-hmm. is that these books, this genre, the theology and ideologies that we give in the church are not oriented toward men. Mm-hmm. The message that men are given is that you need to not masturbate, and that you need to pursue a woman so that you don't burn with passion. Like, those are kind of the main things.
Yeah. No and, porn, find a lady.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yes. But for women, it's like, well, how do you entice that, like, emotional part of you? And the more that that kind of gets massaged, once, like, a mediocre Christian man comes around, a lot of us might believe that that is love, because we've been told that that's what that is. And I know a lot of women who have gotten married to men and have been like, I don't even know if I liked this person. Mm. They just checked the boxes of the things that I was told I should marry, or of the people I was told I should marry. And so I did. And now I feel stuck in this thing. And, like, marriage is a spiritual battle. And so now that the romance, or, like, the nice feelings, or the pursuit is gone, and the naughtiness is gone from sex and all of that, marriage is just, like, a spiritual battle that I fight for the sake of my faith. And so marriage, it goes from being this thing that's supposed to draw you closer to God somehow to something that you have to fight for and fight for and fight for and fight for over and over again. And I've just had a lot of issues with that concept, where I'm like, okay, sure. Fidelity, mutuality, consent, all of those things, I think, can be challenging. And if all of you, that your marriage is fighting, that doesn't say a lot of good things about your Christianity or the God that you think ordained that marriage in the first place.
Yes. And I think, like, in general culture, romance plays such a wide variety of roles for people, right? Some people read it to discover more about themselves, to discover mm-hmm. kinks, to discover what is attractive to them, what they like, how to ask for what they like, to explore various ways of being, you know, all this stuff. Christian mm-hmm. romance has one goal, right? And so I think that's the thing that makes it so different. I also think, bigger picture, Christian romance, which is all aimed at women, it's bought by women, it's, you know, all of mm-hmm. that stuff, is not about autonomy or developing autonomy, but it is sort of like, how do you prepare yourself to settle for a man who says he follows God, right? That's kind mm-hmm. of the vibe I got. And this is why I felt so out of step with my peers, is I could not talk myself into liking any of these mediocre white boys. Like, I just couldn't. But other people do, and I think there's real reasons for that, including, mm-hmm. right, that's what they were told is romance, is yes. a man says he follows God, or is at least trying. Mm-hmm. What a low bar.
It's an entirely low bar, and I feel like yeah, folks who are socialized as men should really want a higher bar than that. But in churches, that's not the case necessarily.
And some of them did. And let's be clear, there's plenty of gender nonconforming boys and men, right? Mm-hmm. Sitting through these same purity culture, Christian romance bullshit.
Yes.
Like, it's, there's a lot of little weirdos out there. I mean that very affectionately. And these intensely strict hierarchies and binaries just suffocated so many people. And yeah. Anywho, I feel kind of sad now, but I'm also I'm so happy that so many people are just finding the space to be curious and creative and to develop autonomy if that's something they were not given access to. And if anybody's sort of stuck in the sads of it all, I just want to say, like, we're doing the work, and the more we can know ourselves, right, this is so much more, and again, maybe this is the demisexual aromantic part of me, but it's like, the more we can develop these relationships with ourselves and our own bodies, like, that's going to have such positive ramifications.
Yes.
For any other relationship, be it romantic, sexual, platonic, whatever. Knowing ourselves and knowing our bodies, like, oh my God, any little thing you can do to connect to yourself, it has such positive benefits.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And so I say, go read some romance that is not Christian and see if you like some of it. I don't know. I've had such a fun time reclaiming reading romance books in the past few years, which is a shock to me because I didn't love it that much. And so I'm like, I'm really enjoying that.
Yes. I also think, and again, say what you will about whatever, but I'm like, this is part of where I think Christians have benefited from Bridgerton. That show is whack in so many ways, and the dynamics are so chaotic. But I think there's places that I'm realizing that Christians have just never had a pop culture reason to be able to explore in a culturally meaningful way what they might think is, like, romantic, or what is sexually arousing to them, or what feels romantic to them. And again, all that stuff, a lot of it's super abusive, super weird, super problematic. Shonda does not have the greatest history around writing romance stories that decenter patriarchal male violence. But I think there is something about people just going, oh, I think that's sexy, or oh, I would want to experience something like that. Or, oh, that type of a whole season that's based around longing. Like, oh, I want a relationship that has an experience of longing. Allows people to ask the question, what do I like? And that's the problem with romance, is that romance is entirely subjective. And when we are given a culturally manufactured, particularly Christian culturally manufactured image of what romance is, what that does is it tells us what we are supposed to like and what we are supposed to want and what we are supposed to pursue. And at the end of the day, as you're talking about autonomy, I'm like, oh yeah, most of us can start to unlearn the Christian romance, or like the kind of Christian cultural romance messages that exist in secular media too, by asking, you know, for folks who experience sexual attraction, like, what do I like sexually? Like, what do I like? What do I want? And for people who don't, and for people who experience sexual attraction too, asking, what are the things that make me feel loved, or that elicit, like, kind of like strong, you know, emotions that are connected to love in me? What are the things that make me feel loved, cared for, seen, known, desired, held, safe? And that those types of questions can tell us what we would think is romantic. Because again, we just got past Valentine's Day, and I saw, you know, there's a million memes of like, women don't want flowers for Valentine's Day. And I'm like, but if you do, that's fine. Like, if you want someone to get you flowers, that's great. If you want someone to bake you a pie,
great. That's great. Love flowers. And I just think you're so right. I think the sexiest thing, again, I'm autistic, I think the sexiest thing is when my nervous system is not on high alert. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's what I love. I know that's not everybody's cup of tea, but there's something to be said for knowing how your own body responds to other people, and just using these as tools to help us live more pleasurable lives. And that was so not what I was supposed to be doing as a good little Christian girl.
Yes. And I think I just want to encourage people to be specific in the things that you explore and know and like, and articulate those things. Like, there's some things I'm learning just now in partnership, like, what is romantic to me, and like, what feels good to me, and what is right for me. And like, my partner and I write a letter to each other every month because we're long distance. And it's like one of the most romantic things for me is that we like take time each month to think about each other and to write down things that we're reflecting on. And that's like really beautiful to me. I don't think that's everybody's thing, but it really works for us. And so I think that there's ways that I'm discovering things like that, that aren't complicated or stereotypical necessarily. They're just good. And I think that there's an opportunity for Christians who are, or people who are adjacent to Christian culture or who have been Christian, socialized as Christian, even that is a thing, to say, what do I like and what would I want from a partner? And can I ask for that? And my asking for that does not make them doing it because I asked less romantic. If we're having to nag partners to do things that feel like right for us, that's not great. But asking for the things we want just allows us to have more satisfying and pleasurable lives, getting our needs met and being cared for in ways that matter to us.
Yeah, don't pray about it. Just ask for what you need. Okay? I mean, you can pray if you want, but you should also ask for what you need.
Yes. Well, are there any final thoughts you have on this idea of Christian romance and the conversation that we've had so far?
Yeah, I just think if something is predicated on a white woman remaining a virgin until she marries a white man and having a bunch of kids, that's positive eugenics, folks. And we need to call it what it is. They have made it very clear that that's what it was. And it, you know, anywho.
And there's literature to back that up.
The next time you see all the Amish women. Yeah, I do want to shout out, there is someone doing amazing work on this. Sarah Mosliner, am I saying her name right? She wrote a book, I believe, called Virgin Nation. Now, I haven't read the book yet. I have it, but she's been doing this amazing research connecting like purity culture, Christian romance to these, you know, white supremacist movements. So everybody should check out her work.
Interesting. Will do. Well, is there anything you want to plug? Where can people find your work and what you're up to in the world?
Yeah, I did just put up a post on my Substack. This might come out later. My Substack is called Healing is My Special Interest. I did one with some autistic Valentines. That was fun to make. All these little things autistic people like and find romantic. So that was really fun. But you can find me there. I also do a podcast called The Prophetic Imagination Station with my partner Crispin. We did do a 3-part series on Christian Zionism that talked about these specific Christian romance books. If you want to check that out. So there we go.
Yeah. Yep. Highly encourage people to listen to that, particularly in this time where we're starting to discover what is in the water that we've been swimming in for a long time, or in the air we breathe. So thank you so much for that. I hope people can find your work and find it, yeah, connecting and meaningful for them. And I'm just so grateful for this time with you today.
I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for joining for another episode of Reclaiming My Theology. I just appreciate y'all so much and want to continue to make content that helps us to get more free and have a spirituality, or at least an experience or interpretation of our previous spirituality, that is helpful, life-giving, and freeing. We're going to do a question and answer period around purity culture pretty soon, so if you have questions, please send them to us at reclaimingmytheology@gmail.com or over DMs on Instagram. You can do that in voice memo form, video form, or in text. And so please just let us know what your questions are, so that as we engage with them and go deeper than I can take us ourselves, that we would do a little bit better together. See you next week.